held steadfastly to her dream, thinking that as soon as I reached my late teens, I would become the Iranian daughter whom she could relate to, the daughter who would dutifully let her parents help her select a mate. Ever since we came to America, I had regarded my mother as a mere source of entertainment. This was a woman whose English required translation into English, a woman who listed the Gordines in her phone book under N for neighbor, but who listed her hairdresser, Patricia, under A, so her number would be on the first page. She had attended one PTA meeting during my entire educational career and had not understood a single word. Whenever I was required to bring a snack for some club meeting, my mother always wanted to make feta cheese and basil rolled in flatbread, or cholezard, a neon yellow dessert made with saffron. Forget it, I always told her, wishing she could just figure out how to make oatmeal raisin cookies. My mother was, in American adolescent vernacular, out of it. Perhaps the people we think we know the best are the ones who surprise us most. Once my mother realized that I wanted to marry François, she said, "He will be like a third son to me," and wiped the tears off her face. At that very moment, my mother threw aside everything she and her generation knew about marriage and entered a new world where daughters select their own husbands. She became a pioneer. My father was just happy that I was getting married. Having only one daughter, he was particularly pleased that François asked his permission to marry me. François later told me that while delivering his "please take good care of my daughter" speech, my father kept trying on my engagement ring on his own finger. "I just made sure he knew I wasn't proposing to him," François reported. As soon as our wedding plans became official, we started making the guest list. Despite initial misgivings, François's parents decided to attend. François's sister number two also agreed to come to the wedding. His maternal grandmother, whom he adored and considered to be his biggest influence, decided not to attend. François's oldest sister declined to come, stating that there was no way she would be in the same room as her mother or sister number two. Brother-in-law number one, whom François had known since the age of seven, declined to come, stating that having been virtually disinherited by his in-laws, he could not possibly attend. Brother-in-law number two declined to come, probably because there just isn't enough Mylanta in the world. François's only maternal aunt was not invited because she and my mother-in-law had fought over some land in Greece 20 years ago and were not on speaking terms. None of his four maternal cousins was invited, and I never asked why. I doubt they would have attended anyway. His paternal aunt and uncle declined to attend, as did their adult children. François's paternal grandmother did decide to attend, enlarging François's side of the wedding party to a whopping four family members. In contrast to François's family, mine were busy making plans for a joyous occasion. My parents, like Santa Claus, were faced with a long list of names. This was the first wedding among my siblings, and my parents could not possibly fathom leaving anybody out. The reception hall had a maximum capacity of 165, which is a problem when just the aunts, uncles, cousins, and second cousins add up to 98 people. My parents agonized over the guest list, recalling every one of their friends back in Abadan. "We can't possibly leave them out," became a regular refrain. I didn't know half the people on the list. "Who are the Abbasis and why are we inviting them?" I wanted to know. "They invited us to their daughter's wedding last year. Plus, they live in Australia. They won't come." They came, and they brought a niece with them. On a dozen occasions, invitations addressed to Mr. and Mrs. came back announcing that six people would be attending. Since our wedding was taking place in the summer, our guests, who themselves had house guests, decided to just bring them along. We invited 140 people. 163 accepted. 181 showed up. François and I had agreed that we would be married both in the Catholic Church and in a traditional Persian ceremony. The tough part was finding a Catholic priest who would be willing to officiate at a mixed marriage. François called several churches, but was told that he would have to go to the church where he was a member. François had attended church a handful of times in his entire life. He was as Catholic as I was Muslim. I decided to try contacting the Catholic Church in my neighborhood in Newport Beach. I called and told the priest that my future husband was French, but we hoped to get married in Southern California, where my family lived. I told him that of course I had never attended church because I was Muslim, but if I were Catholic, I would have attended his church since it was my neighborhood Catholic church. "Well," he said. I continued, "I'm a very decent person. I could be Catholic, Jewish, you name it. All religions basically say the same thing, and I would just fit right in any of them." "Well, that's not exactly," he said. "What I mean is that they all work toward the same goal," I interrupted. Maybe he knew no other way to end the conversation, but the priest agreed to meet with me. Father Christopher turned out to be a kind and enlightened man with a wonderful sense of humor. He agreed to marry us, although our wedding would not include the communion. It was sort of a Catholic ceremony light. We had to meet with them a dozen times to discuss married life and religion. We also had to attend a retreat held at a convent, which was aimed at preparing us for the challenges of marriage. On the first day, one of the speakers mentioned a seminar about the unique challenges faced by mixed marriages. I attended, but found out that the mixed marriages he referred to did not involve Jews or Muslims, but rather Protestants, Orthodox Christians, and others who still believe in Jesus Christ, but with a different set of details. Planning the Persian ceremony, or akd, was by far the simplest part of our wedding. Ever since immigrating to America, my Aunt Sedire and Uncle Abdullah had earned a living by translating official documents and serving as notary publics. Uncle Abdullah also officiated at akd ceremonies, a job that allowed him to utilize his in-depth knowledge of Arabic and the Quran. More important, this job meant that Aunt Sedire had the scoop on every impending marriage for miles around. The akd ceremony is traditionally held at the bride's house and is limited to family members and close friends. Our guests also included my second grade teacher, Mrs. Sandberg. Since my parents' condominium was too small, my Uncle Ali and Aunt Linda kindly allowed us the use of their house. This was a fitting choice, because Uncle Ali was the first person in my family to marry a non-Iranian. He had met Linda, a blonde nurse, when he was a medical resident in America. Initially, there was much concern about his choice. Although none of us had ever met Linda, obviously, she did not know how to make Persian food. What would become of my Uncle Ali? Could an Iranian man survive life without basmati rice and lamb stew? Not only did Linda become a fabulous Persian cook, she also learned Italian cooking and became the quintessential hostess. She accomplished this while being employed full-time helping Ali run his medical practice. Now the family wonders what my uncle would have ever done without her. He got lucky, they all agree. In preparing for the akd, we needed a sofre, which is traditionally a hand-sewn cloth, roughly the size of a queen-size bedspread, on which the family arranges foods and objects, all of which hold special meaning. At the head of the sofre are the mirror and candle holders, symbolizing purity and love. Iranian families pass these objects from generation to generation. My father, the hopeless romantic, sold theirs after they were married. This was shortly before he decided to sell my mother's wedding band so they could stay at the Caspian Sea for an extra week. We ended up renting the sofre, the mirror, and the candle holders from an Iranian woman who does a brisk business providing the apparatus for akd ceremonies. For many Iranians, moving to America meant having to leave the large mirror and candelabrum set back home. Thus, a unique rental business was born. The sofre also holds an assortment of sweets, sugar-coated almonds, baklava, almond cookies, and rice cookies. All the sweets were prepared by Aunt Dordune, who is technically not my aunt. She is my cousin Murtaza's wife's aunt, but she has baked her way into everybody's heart, including my husband's, who also calls her Khale, aunt. The week before my wedding, she showed up at our house every day and held marathon baking sessions, filling our house with the aroma of rose water, butter, and roasted nuts. In addition to the sweets, there was also a basket of almonds and walnuts, representing fertility, and a bowl of honey for a sweet life. A platter of feta cheese and herbs and flatbread represented happiness and prosperity. Finally, we had a small wooden tree with carved radishes placed on the tip of each branch, which didn't represent anything but looked cute. The ceremony began with François and me sitting facing the mirror with everybody crowding around the soufre trying to get a good view. Uncle Abdullah began his speech in Persian, read passages from the Quran in Arabic, then translated everything into English. While he was doing his part, several aunts and female cousins held a small cloth over our heads and rubbed two sugar loaves together. This is supposed to ensure the raining of happiness into the couple's life. When we were finally asked whether we wanted to marry each other, the groom is supposed to answer yes right away, but the bride is expected to take her sweet time and cause a little bit of last-minute anxiety for the groom and his family. When my uncle asked whether I wanted to marry François, I said nothing. My family yelled the traditional response, "She has gone to pick flowers!" My uncle repeated his question. Again, I said nothing. The family yelled, "She has gone to bring rose water!" My uncle asked a third time. This time, I said yes. Everyone cheered as my uncle declared us husband and wife. When I call my parents at home, I usually speak to my mother first. When I ask to speak to my father, I often hear him yell in the background, "Tell her I've gone to pick flowers!" If I happen to be in a hurry, I'll tell my mother to ask him to stop his nonsense and pick up the phone. Then I hear him say, "Tell her I've gone to get some rose water." He finds this very amusing. After the act was over, everybody hugged and kissed, then hugged and kissed some more. This was followed by everybody taking pictures and everybody crowding into everybody else's picture. The picture taking went on for a couple of hours, during which François complained that his face hurt from having to smile so much. And he added, "I've never been kissed by so many people in one day." It's difficult to separate Iranians from their tradition of endlessly hugging and kissing on both cheeks. Women kiss women, men kiss women, and big, hairy men kiss other burly men. Foreigners, especially men, tend to find this tradition a bit disconcerting. Since the French also kiss twice on the cheek, François was not completely frightened by the throng of relatives waiting to give him a peck. He did, however, complain about certain relatives whose pecks were a little juicier than he would have liked. I've known Americans who, unaware of the kissing ritual, have wanted to run for the nearest exit at the sight of a puckering Iranian uncle approaching with open arms. Even after my church ceremony, when everyone is supposed to leave the church quietly and in order, my relatives broke into a major kissing ceremony, making us look as if we had never been to a church wedding before, which was true. The most difficult part of my wedding was finding a location for the reception. Iranian weddings usually start at 10 p.m. and end at 2 a.m. This eliminates all clubs and outdoor venues. Iranian food must be served. This eliminates all hotels, which make most of their money from their own catering. We had a small budget. This eliminated all locations with landscaping or English-speaking employees. Our reception ended up in an Indian-Chinese restaurant near the airport. The business had started out as an Indian restaurant, but sales had been slow. Showing true immigrant tenacity, the owners added Chinese items as well. This was a place where one could order tandoori chicken or crab foo young, lentil soup or fish ball soup, and where the condiments included both soy sauce and chutney. The restaurant reminded me of a Pakistani rug shop I know in Northern California, which in addition to carpets started selling used computer parts, and eventually added falafel. I assume, given a few years, leg waxing will also be a part of their repertoire. The manager of the restaurant was a large Indian man with an overhanging stomach. The big tummy worked on Buddha, but not on this guy. To add to his appeal, the whites of his eyes were the color of egg yolks and were further highlighted by being permanently bloodshot. This man could have easily been in Star Wars. The night of my wedding, he stood in front of the locked door to the restaurant and said, "I will only let you in if you give me an extra $400 in cash right now." With the guests arriving in an hour, my father, who is significantly smaller than the manager, didn't have many options. Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, I did not hear about this until a few weeks after the fact. It's fair to say the bride's yelling and screaming would not have made for the most memorable wedding day moment. Our reception was a typical Iranian party with lots of music, too much makeup, and great food. As Francois and I entered, everyone stood up and cheered. We went around to each table, receiving more hugs, kisses, and wishes for a happy future. Aunt Sadira followed us, throwing tiny, fake gold Persian coins over our heads. In ancient Persia, the gold would have been real. Everyone, even the busboys, knew the coins were fake. Everyone, that is, except for my new sister-in-law, who spent the evening feverishly collecting them. When it came time to eat, we were the first ones in line, followed by Father Christopher. "This is one reception I don't want to miss," he had told us. The meal consisted of the traditional sweet carrot rice with almonds, saffron, and chicken, lima bean rice with lamb shanks, eggplant stew, herb stew, stuffed grape leaves, and cucumber, tomato, and herb salad. My parents had also ordered an entire lamb to be roasted. The Persians, like the Romans and Greeks before them, believe in slaughtering a lamb when something good happens. This is supposed to ward off the evil eye. Marriages, job offers, new cars, and new babies are always accompanied by this ancient ritual. In Iran, families who cannot afford a lamb use a chicken. Wealthier families usually donate the meat to the poor. Iranians in America have had to tweak this tradition a bit. Slaughtering a lamb on one's front porch in Los Angeles might not do much for the neighborhood, so when something good happens that calls for a lamb slaughter, who are you going to call? Relatives in Iran, that's who. Lambs are now slaughtered long distance and distributed to the poor in Iran. Your son bought a Lexus? There goes a lamb. The grandson graduated from UCLA Law School? Don't forget the lamb. For my wedding, the Iranian caterer told us that for an extra $250, which in Iran buys an entire flock of sheep plus the sheep herder's wages, he would roast a lamb and present it as a centerpiece. My response was, "Oh God, no." But it's not like the bride's opinion stands a chance against tradition. With more fanfare than my own entrance got, the result was wheeled out at the beginning of dinner. Francois and I gasped. There on the cart was not a lamb, but a lamb carcass, all the meat having been already carved off. On top of its skull was a conical party hat, and where its eyes had once been sat a pair of sunglasses. This creature did not belong at a wedding, but on the cover of a Stephen King novel. Father Christopher announced that he was ready to perform the last rites, a perfectly funny Catholic joke wasted on this crowd. Dinner was followed by more dancing. The DJ played everything from Persian songs to top 40 hits to salsa. The dance floor remained full until the time came to throw the bouquet. This is not an Iranian tradition, but any ritual that might lead to finding a husband is quickly and readily adopted into my culture. With all eligible females holding their breath, I threw my bouquet, then turned around to see who the next bride would be. There, standing at my reception, at my wedding, was a complete stranger holding my bouquet of yellow orchids. As the photographer scrambled to take her picture, I found my mother to ask her who that was. "That's Sohela, the daughter of Mojda Khanum, who's babysitting your Aunt Zeddy's grandkids tonight. She wants to get married, but she's really tall, so it's hard to find an Iranian husband. So your Aunt Zeddy brought her, thinking that she might meet someone at your wedding. Although, personally, I don't think so. She really is too tall." I could only hope that my wedding would work a bit of magic for this uninvited guest. I like to think that she eventually found a husband, a tall Iranian doctor, maybe, or perhaps a short Mexican businessman with a big heart, or a medium-built Irish Catholic book vendor whose family thinks she's the best thing that ever happened to their son. But regardless of her husband's ethnicity, one thing's for sure. If she did get married, there are a couple fewer lambs in Iran. I feel the earth move under my feet. After getting married, François and I moved to San Francisco, where we rented an apartment on the top floor of a four-story building. The building was a quiet one, and the tenants mainly kept to themselves. The second floor was populated entirely by old women living alone. Every morning, each of them would leave the building for a daily stroll, taking tenuous steps with the help of a walker or a caretaker. A month after moving into our apartment, I returned home from work early one day to take care of a few errands. I was about to get into the shower when the phone rang. I put on my bathrobe and answered the phone. It was someone from UPS returning my call regarding a wedding gift that had arrived broken. As I was trying to explain that no, I did not have a receipt for the gift, the room started to shake and rattle. The pictures, which François had just hung on the wall, crashed to the floor, sending broken glass everywhere. The kitchen cabinets burst open and glasses and dishes flew out, shattering on the tile floor. As disturbing as it is to hear the sound of just one glass shattering, I was now hearing dozens of glass objects breaking in every room at the same time. Having grown up in California, I had always heard about the big one, the inevitable huge earthquake that awaited all of us who chose to live in sunshine instead of reason. I assumed this was it. My first thought was that the building was going to fall. I considered putting on some clothes other than the terry cloth bathrobe I was wearing, but then I thought, who cares? The floor was covered with broken glass, so I grabbed the first pair of shoes I saw, François's bunny slippers. I also took a pillow to protect my head from falling debris. As I was about to leave the apartment, I thought of my parents. I had to call them. I picked up the phone, but the line was dead. This disturbed me more than the earthquake itself. My parents are highly evolved worriers. My mother once called me in the middle of the day to tell me to make sure I wear shoes when cleaning the attic because she had just heard about a woman who, while cleaning her attic barefoot, was bitten by a rare brown spider whose venom cut off the circulation to her extremities. Consequently, the woman's nose fell off. It was pointless for me to remind my mother that I do not have an attic. My parents do not limit themselves to worrying about things that have actually happened. Dreams are also fair game. I often get phone calls with detailed descriptions of a dream, followed by, "So naturally, I had to call to make sure you were okay, and there wasn't a reason why I dreamed of you trapped in a canoe with a blue turtle." If worrying were an Olympic sport, my parents' faces would have graced the Wheaties box a long time ago. I tried the phone again, but it was still dead. I left my apartment and started walking down the stairs, holding the pillow on my head with both hands. The quake had activated the fire alarm, so the hallways were ringing. As I reached the second floor, I saw one of the old ladies standing in her doorway, shaking uncontrollably. Her face had no color. My first thought was that this person was about to have a heart attack. "Let's leave the building. There are probably going to be aftershocks," I told her. She just stared at me. I put my arms around her tiny, shaking body and started stroking her head. She was trembling like a little bird. In a thick Eastern European accent, she haltingly told me that she just wanted to go back to her apartment. Still holding and stroking her, I stepped into her apartment and sat down on the sofa. I told her that everything was okay and that we had nothing to worry about. I did not believe a word I was saying, but she apparently did. After a while, the color started slowly coming back into her face. I again suggested leaving the building, but she refused. By the time I decided to leave, she looked normal and was telling me how glad she was that her favorite lamp had not broken. Before stepping out of her apartment, I asked her if I could try using her phone. I picked up the phone and heard a dial tone. I called my parents and was greeted cheerfully by my father, who clearly had not heard about the earthquake. "Baba," I said, "there was a big earthquake, but I just wanted to let you know that I'm okay." "No problem," he answered cheerfully. "How's everything else?" My father was not grasping the gravity of the situation, and I had no idea how to describe the earthquake without the handy Richter scale number. "It was a big earthquake. Everything broke," I told him. "Don't worry," he said. "Things are replaceable. Just know I'm okay, I said. I gotta go. As soon as I hung up, I thought that I should also call my in-laws, who at the time were living in Marin County, 45 minutes from San Francisco. Ever since marrying Francois, I had clung to the notion that my mother-in-law, in a moment of enlightenment, would cast aside her prejudices and join Francois and me in celebrating our union. I imagined us preparing elaborate Christmas dinners together and her telling me for the 100th time how narrow-minded she had been before getting to know me. And for the 100th time, I would tell her that I forgave her. I dialed my in-law's number. My mother-in-law picked up the phone. I was pretty sure this would be the moment of bonding. It would go something like this. Oh, dear Firouzeh, this earthquake shook me up and made me realize what a fool I've been. How could I have judged you because of your nationality? What was I thinking? Muslims, Jews, Catholics, we're all the same. Imagine it took me this long to wake up and see that we all laugh the same laughs and cry the same tears. Please forgive me. I got it almost right. My mother-in-law asked whether her china had broken. Before the wedding, François had discovered in his parents' garage 2 large boxes of Limoges china that had never been unpacked. François had never seen these dishes. He assumed they were yet another box of inherited dishes that his parents owned, but had never gotten around to using. He asked his mother whether he could have them. In a rare moment of generosity, she said yes. For weeks following the Loma Prieta earthquake, building inspectors measured the damage and labeled structures with green, yellow, or red stickers. Ours was given a yellow sticker, which, unlike a red sticker, meant that we could return to our homes. However, many repairs needed to be made. The elevator had to be fixed for the elderly residents, but otherwise, we didn't expect much. We had come to accept that our landlord's idea of maintenance was cashing the rent checks. One evening, a few weeks after the earthquake, there was a knock on our door. I opened the door, and standing there was the elderly lady I had met during the earthquake. She was holding a chocolate bundt cake. As soon as she saw me, she burst into tears. Handing me the cake, she took out a wad of tissue and said, "I just wanted to tell you." But she got no further. Her sobs got louder. "I just wanted to tell you," she said again, "that you saved my life. My name is Golda Rubinstein, and you saved my life." She continued to sob. I thanked her and told her that she had actually saved my parents' life, since her phone was the only one working, and she didn't let me finish. "I just wanted to thank you and make sure you knew that you saved my life." I thanked her for the cake again and told her I was glad that she was fine. I also thanked her again for letting me use her phone. For a week after the earthquake, all the phones in our building had been dead. My parents later told me that after my phone call, they had turned on the news and seen the devastation. "Had it not been for your phone call," they always say, "we would have worried ourselves to death." Golda's was the only phone in the entire building that had been working. A month later, Golda made another surprise visit, this time bringing only half a chocolate bundt cake. Once again, I opened my door, and she burst into tears. Handing me the cake, she took out a wad of tissue. In between sobs, she said, "I called my son, and I says, Yaakov, an angel came to me. An angel saved my life." Listening to her own reenactment of the phone call, she sobbed louder. I thanked her for the cake and told her how grateful I was for what she had done for my parents, but she didn't want to hear any of it. Every month, like clockwork, Golda came to our door with half a chocolate bundt cake, a heart full of gratitude, and eyes full of tears. One time, when I wasn't home, she had encountered François and asked him whether he knew that he was married to an angel. She had also told him that he was too skinny, and she was going to fatten him up. Fortunately, or unfortunately, I wasn't sure which, my mother-in-law's china had not broken. The earthquake did, however, make her rethink her impulsive burst of generosity. This did not surprise us. I would not be singing Kumbaya with this woman any time soon. As beautiful as they were, 2 words now describe these dishes: bad karma. François wanted to give them back and forget the whole thing. I was willing to get rid of them, but I did not want to give them back to his mother. I also didn't want to sell them. I figured their bad karma would extend to any money that we made from them. A home for families of children undergoing long-term treatment at a nearby hospital was having a benefit auction. I contacted the organization. Were they interested in a 70-piece set of antique Limoges? They were. After the auction, we received a letter thanking us for our donation and informing us of the selling price. We were thrilled that somebody now owned a beautiful set of china that came with no strings attached. More important, we were happy to have helped out a family that was dealing with a gravely ill child. And if feeling good wasn't enough of a reward, we were now considered major donors to the organization. For the next few years, we were honored guests at a handful of dinners for major donors, all of which were held at elaborate homes where the paintings on the walls were not reproductions. These were catered events with valet parking. At the time, we owned one car, a Honda with a large ding on the side. I always suggested to François that perhaps we should park our car a few blocks away and walk. François refused, insisting that should he suddenly wake up and find himself a multimillionaire, he would like to think of himself as the type who wouldn't be a slave to status symbols, the type who would still remember the little people and the cars driven by the little people. Plus, he added, maybe the valets will get mixed up and give us a BMW. At these dinners, we met all sorts of people whose names graced museums and large institutions. These were people who had not had a financial worry in three generations. At age 26, François and I were by far the youngest guests. Knowing that our days at these swanky shindigs were numbered, we tried to make the most of them by trying each and every one of the desserts. We never did tell my mother-in-law about the china. She never accepted our marriage. Even the birth of our children did not soften her. We eventually stopped having contact with her. The Limoges set has brought us more joy in its absence than it ever did in our cupboards. Of course, we no longer own a set of china to pass down to our kids, but that's okay. François and I plan on giving our children something more valuable. The simple truth that the best way to go through life is to be a major donor of kindness. We'll tell them that it's possible to own a whole bunch of beautiful, valuable things and still be miserable. But sometimes, just having a recipe for chocolate bundt cake can make a person far, far happier. A nose by any other name. When I was a student at Berkeley, I found myself fascinated by a certain librarian there. This woman had the ugliest nose I had ever seen. It was as if God, in a moment of confusion, had switched her nose with the beak of an exotic bird. I suspected that somewhere deep in the rainforests of Brazil, high in a mango tree, lived a toucan with a human nose. What triggered my fascination wasn't the sheer majesty of the librarian's nose, but her abundant confidence. This woman carried herself like a beauty queen. As I watched her go about her duties in her self-assured manner, I couldn't help but wonder, why doesn't she have a complex? In Iranian culture, a woman's nose is much more than a breathing device. It is her destiny. A girl with an ugly nose learns early on to dream of one thing only, a skilled plastic surgeon. Only the poorest families do not intervene to correct nature's nasal missteps. No amount of charm, talent, or intelligence can make a girl overcome an ugly nose. It simply must be fixed. I am descended from two types of noses. On my father's side, the noses are big, but otherwise perfectly reasonable. God just didn't know when to stop a good thing. The noses in my maternal lineage are all large and hooked. Gonzo on Sesame Street bears an uncanny resemblance to my mother's side of the family. I grew up thinking that it was normal to yell, "Not the profile!" whenever a picture was being taken. Mine is the kind of nose that enabled me to impress fellow high school students with my ability to balance a pencil and eraser between my nose and mouth. This enviable contortion act pretty much sealed my fate as the type of girl who never had to worry about buying a prom dress. When I was small, all eyes were on my nose. I was considered a cute little girl, but whenever anyone commented on my looks, someone, usually my mother, would say, "We'll see." Everyone knew what that meant. History is full of girls who were cute one day, and then boom, the nose grew. And my female relatives had known them all. They continued their nose watch, tracking my rhinal growth like traders tracking stock on Wall Street. By the time I was an adolescent, it was clear that I had been somewhat spared. I had a hooked nose light. I resembled my maternal relatives, but the nose wasn't quite bad enough to invite comparison to a puppet. The consensus among my female relatives was that even though my nose wasn't horrific, it could use a little improvement. You just need the tip removed. When I was 18, my father and I headed off to a consultation with a plastic surgeon, the best in Newport Beach. As I sat in this man's well-appointed office and looked at the expansive ocean view, I wondered how he could take himself seriously. Judging by the framed diplomas all over the walls, he had spent many years studying at prestigious medical establishments. Here was somebody who could be saving a life somewhere, but instead he was looking forward to lopping off the tip of my nose. As he explained the procedure, what bothered me the most wasn't the idea of having my nose broken, but having my nose broken by him. I just didn't respect him enough. My father was relieved that I had decided against a nose job. He thought it was way too expensive. "You can buy me a car instead," I suggested. "Your nose is fine," he replied, "and you don't need a car." Despite the ominous warnings from my female relatives that noses keep growing well into adulthood, I managed to graduate from college, get married, and have children, all with my original nose. I hadn't actually thought about my nasal imperfections in years. After two pregnancies, I had found other body parts far worthier of obsession. I had, however, thought about the toucan. Whenever anyone complained about his nose, I always shared the story of the confident librarian who had overcome her formidable rhinal challenge. Naturally, people wanted to know why she had so much confidence. "I don't know, she just did," I always replied. Little did I dream that I would someday find out. About 20 years after my last sighting of the toucan, Francois and I and our two kids were on our way to a motel for a week. Our house was on the market, and the real estate agent felt that it would sell more quickly if we weren't in it. Somehow, toys scattered throughout the house and toilets that the little ones had forgotten to flush are not considered a marketing boon. Francois and I cleaned the house, removed all the extra things we had stuffed in our closets, put fresh vases full of flowers everywhere, and left. We arrived at the local motel just in time to go to bed. While we were putting the kids to sleep, Francois was called in to work. As soon as he left, every article I had ever read about crimes being committed in motel rooms came flooding back to me. I was convinced that the moment I fell asleep, a disgruntled ex-employee who had managed to keep the master key would come back to avenge himself. I was not going to be able to sleep until my husband returned. Desperate for a distraction, I turned on the TV. Since we don't have a television in our house, I assumed it would be fairly easy to find something entertaining, if only for the novelty. I started flipping channels, avoiding the in-depth profiles of serial murderers, zipping past the sitcoms, past the infomercials selling juicers, past Susan Lucci selling shampoo. Just as I was thinking, "Thank God I don't have a television, so I don't have to watch this crap," all of a sudden, there she was on the screen, the toucan. She looked exactly the same, except for a few more gray hairs. I assumed that this was a show about the Dewey Decimal System or recent donations to the UC Berkeley Library. But suddenly, the camera panned back, and I saw that the toucan was completely naked. My father had always told me that a college education would give me endless opportunities. I never realized that seeing the librarians naked would be one of them. I was intrigued and repulsed at the same time. I looked to make sure my children were sleeping. They were still at the age when they readily announced every detail of our life to perfect strangers. Mommy watches naked women on television might not get them into the best preschools. I hoped that Francois would not come home and think I was hiding some big secret. I sat back to watch the interview, more awake now than before. The naked toucan had startled me more than any axe-wielding, disgruntled ex-employee. According to the interview, the toucan was a member of a nudist colony in Northern California. This in-depth profile covered not only her experiences as a nudist, but also the experiences of the other nudists. The toucan talked extensively about coming to accept herself as she is. She didn't refer to her nose, but that's what I was thinking about. She said that she had struggled with low self-esteem her whole life until she discovered nudism. Somehow, she had shed her clothes and her poor self-image simultaneously, a concept that could truly put a dent in the world of cosmetic surgery. How odd, I thought, that I had so wondered about this woman's self-confidence, and my question was being answered on an obscure cable show in a cheap motel at midnight. The toucan continued listing the virtues of nudity, how being naked took away all pretenses and left others to see her for who she really was. I had always thought that conversation revealed who people really were, but apparently seeing their saggy body parts could actually tell me a whole lot more. The other members of the colony said basically the same thing as the toucan, although she was by far the most articulate, not to mention the best looking. Before this show, I had assumed that watching a group of naked people would be erotic in some way, not this group. I was not the only one who had not gone to the prom. The show ended with a scene of all the nudists sitting around a campfire, laughing and bonding. Watching this jovial group, I found myself overcome with sadness. I couldn't help but think of all the Iranian women who had paid to have their noses broken and reshaped just so someone might find them worthy of love. I thought of all the little girls I had known who would learn to cringe at their own reflections. I remembered how much I admired Jane Fonda's nose when I was in fourth grade in Tehran, and how much I hated my own. Thinking of all that wasted energy, I wanted to scream and tell my fellow countrymen and countrywomen that a nose by any other name is just a nose. It does not hold the soul, for no matter how big our noses may be, our souls are far, far bigger. My husband was quite surprised to find me awake at 2 a.m. when he returned from work. "What have you been doing?" he asked. "Watching television." "But you hate television," he reminded me. "Believe me," I said, "there are some interesting shows nowadays." Judges paid off. My brother Fashi travels frequently on business. Having accumulated enough mileage to travel to the moon and back, business class, he regularly treats family and friends to free trips to faraway lands. After our first year of marriage, he offered Francois and me tickets to the Bahamas, if we were interested. We were interested. The timing was perfect. Both Francois and I had just changed jobs, and we each had a 2-week break. Neither of us had ever been to the Bahamas, but how can you go wrong with white sandy beaches, warm water, and swaying palm trees? We landed in Nassau, where we had reservations for 2 nights. We had not made any further plans, choosing instead a more adventurous approach. "Let's get there and see which island beckons us," was our motto. There's a fine line between a sense of adventure and stupidity, and we had crossed that line. Once in Nassau, we discovered that there was no island beckoning us. We had arrived smack dab in the middle of spring break, and the Bahamas were full. Full of people far more intelligent than we, who had already made reservations on every boat or plane leaving Nassau for the other islands. We were stuck. Perhaps it is unfair to judge any place during spring break. After all, the students who flock to these resorts are generally not the brightest lights in the American galaxy. These are people for whom a vacation does not officially begin until they have thrown up a couple of times. It seems like such a waste for them to fly to the Bahamas, or anywhere else, since they can just as easily go to a motel in their own neck of the woods and simply pass out for a week. It would serve this country better if these types could have their passports stamped domestic travel only, thereby limiting the damage they do as national embarrassments. During our first night, we were kept up till dawn thanks to the drunken festivities taking place in all the rooms around us and in the hallway. We complained to the management. For $180 a night, we should be entitled to get some sleep. Sorry, they said. Hang loose. We spent the next day desperately trying to find a way to leave Nassau and the Spring Breakers, a locale that would have inspired Dante to add a 10th ring to his hell. Every bus, plane, and boat was full. We walked around town asking the locals if they had any idea how we could get to any of the islands. The locals all shook their heads, then asked us if we wanted to buy Coke. They weren't talking about the fizzy drink. By the end of the first day, I was ready to cry. I had seen no swaying palm trees, just swaying drunks. There was no sea life, just piles of beer-bloated students passed out on the beach. They did resemble groups of elephant seals from far away, but the travel brochure had shown dolphins. We returned to the hotel and asked the security guard whether he had any advice. He suggested we go to the post office and inquire about the mail boats that ferried goods from Nassau to the other islands. They were willing to take passengers, space permitting. We also asked him why the police didn't do anything about all the people trying to sell coke on every corner. "The police are often in on it," he told us. "We have a lot of wealthy cops in the Bahamas." The guidebook that we had purchased in the States listed all the official mail boats. With guidebook in hand, we arrived at the post office and were told there was only one boat, the Spanish Rose, leaving during the next 2 weeks, and it was departing the next morning at 7. I immediately looked it up in my guidebook. It wasn't listed. "It's not on the official list," I informed Francois. "It's probably a drug boat. I'm not going." "What do you think is going to happen?" Francois asked. "We'll be next week's headlines. Dismembered bodies discovered. Camera equipment missing. I am not going," I repeated. We stood arguing on the street corner for a while. Then Francois approached the policeman and asked him whether he had ever heard of a mail boat called the Spanish Rose. "Of course," the policeman said enthusiastically. "See," Francois said, "are you convinced it's legitimate?" I was shocked at the naivete of this Frenchman. "The cop is in on it," I whispered. "He probably lives in a big house on a hill with an ocean view." "That's it," Francois said. "I'm going to come here tomorrow morning at 6. You do what you want. I, however, will be boarding the boat." "Fine," I said. The next morning, we showed up early and found a group of Bahamian families ready to board the Spanish Rose. It looked perfectly safe. Francois asked whether I was embarrassed by the previous day's display of paranoia. "I don't recall," I said, doing my best imitation of a politician on trial. We boarded and found a spot among the crates of tomatoes, potatoes, and eggs, and several cages of live chickens. The boat ride was straight out of a Jacques Cousteau special. We passed by small islands with white beaches and swaying palm trees. The water, which was teeming with fish, changed colors from turquoise to jade to cobalt. Overhead, the cloudless sky presented us with yet another magnificent shade of blue. This was the Bahamas we had dreamed about. 4 hours later, we arrived at the island of Spanish Wells. Our guidebook mentioned only that this small island, inhabited by lobster fishermen, was named after the Spanish sailors who used to come ashore for fresh water. "Excuse us," we asked the first person we saw at the dock, "can you tell us where to find a taxi?" The old man looked us over. "Where are you going?" "We'd like to find a hotel," we answered cheerfully. "I'll give you a ride," he said. We put the suitcase in the trunk and buckled ourselves in. 30 seconds later, he announced, "Here we are." He refused to accept money, but he did tell us to come to his restaurant, where he served the best fried turtle on the islands. Francois's eyes lit up. Gross, I thought. I draw the line at any animal that features prominently in Aesop's fables. The receptionist asked us how long we were planning on staying. About 10 nights, we said. She opened the large reservation book, running her forefinger down each page. She never said a word. She didn't look at us. Just turned the pages slowly. That's it, I thought. They're booked full and we're stranded. Finally, she spoke. This way, she said. The receptionist, who was also the bellhop, carried our bag to our room, then waited for a tip. We asked her whether the hotel was full. All the rooms are vacant, she said. They remained that way during our entire stay. Our room was right on the white sandy beach. The calm blue ocean filled the horizon. Except for a few palm trees, there was nothing else on the beach. We put down our bags and decided to go look for a place to eat. Walking up and down the island, we noticed that the streets were empty. No tourists, no locals. The atmosphere reminded me of a book I had read in junior high about a boy who was the only survivor of an atomic bomb and had to rely on his wits to survive. I couldn't remember anything else about the book, but I knew that if I had to rely on my wits to survive, I was far worse off than the turtles. We went back to our hotel, but the receptionist wasn't there. That was because she was now the waitress at the hotel's restaurant. We were seated after a few minutes and given menus with pictures of lobsters on them. That's what I want, said Francois. Sorry, said the receptionist bellhop waitress, but it's not lobster season. We ordered conch chowder and sandwiches. The service was quite good, but then again, we were the only customers in the restaurant. The food, though, was unbelievably expensive. We later found out that this is because everything has to be brought to Spanish Wells by boat. A box of Cheerios at the island's grocery store, Pinder Market, cost $6.50. While we were eating lunch, the owner of the hotel, a British man, came to say hello. He was thrilled to see us, especially when he found out that we were staying for 10 days. He proceeded to tell us a few facts about the island, how, unlike other Bahamians, the inhabitants of Spanish Wells are all white, and how they work 6 months out of the year catching lobster, earning at least $100,000 per year. This did explain the number of satellite dishes we had seen on our walk. I asked the owner what he did before he moved to Spanish Wells. Well, he said, I worked somewhere you have never heard of. That's what I say whenever anybody asks me where I was born. Where's that? I asked him. Abadan, Iran, he said. I had to hold myself back from an a cappella rendition of It's a Small World. It turns out, not only did this man live in Abadan, he worked at the same company as my father, the National Iranian Oil Company. He knew my old neighborhood, the local clubhouse, and Alfie's, the general store where I bought all my tea sets. After lunch, we set out for a walk along the shore. Big, heavy conch shells littered the beach. I know what I'm bringing back from this trip, I told Francois. Just so you know, he said, you collect it, you carry it home. We saw no other tourists on the island. Francois spent his days reading murder mysteries while I schemed of ways to bring back my growing conch shell collection. Taking breaks from doing nothing, we went on long walks, discovering such unusual sights as a drug plane that had crashed years ago on its way from Colombia. Unfamiliar with the nuances of the cocaine trade, we had no idea that it was a drug plane when we first saw it. That evening, we were enlightened about its unique history by our receptionist bellhop waitress historian. Later, we returned to take pictures in front of its hollowed interior where the bags of cocaine had been stored. This was a classic example of travel brochures leaving out the best tidbits. During our walks, we also discovered the Pinder restaurant, the Pinder bakery, and the Pinder gas station. Back at the hotel, we asked the owner why most of the businesses were called Pinder. He took out the island's phone book. Almost everyone in the book, all 20 pages, was named Pinder. Apparently, the island had been settled by two families, the Pinder family and the Pinder family, and they had kids and made more Pinders, he added. Halfway through our stay, as we were eating yet another frighteningly expensive meal, the owner of the hotel approached our table, sat down, and asked us if we were enjoying our stay. His sudden interest in us made me think that he was about to ask us for something. It reminded me of when I was 6 years old, and Fashid would tell me what a wonderful sister I was, and then ask me to share my Kit Kat bar with him. Sure enough, the Englishman asked us whether we would be willing to do a favor for the people of Spanish Wells. Good God, I thought, drug smuggling. He continued, every year, the girls of Spanish Wells compete in a beauty pageant. It's the biggest event of the year, and every girl dreams of winning the title and qualifying for the Miss Bahamas pageant. The problem is that we can never find judges who are not related to the contestants, since, as you've noticed, it's a small island. We were wondering if you two would do us the honor of serving as judges in this year's pageant. I hate beauty pageants. This may have to do with the fact that I was one of those girls who learn early on that they will have to rely on their brains to open doors. It took me years to overcome the beauty expectations of Iranian culture, and a few more years to overcome growing up in Newport Beach, where the standard of beauty involves rigorous exercise, bottles of hydrogen peroxide, and silicone. There was no way I was going to dip my toe in the dysfunctional pond of beauty pageants. As if reading my mind, the Englishman continued, "It's not just about beauty. There's a talent competition and a question-and-answer segment. Please consider this, since otherwise we don't have enough judges." There wasn't much we could say. "We'll do it," we said. "Splendid," he exclaimed. The next morning, when the receptionist, bellhop, waitress, historian, maid came to clean the room, she greeted us with unusual enthusiasm. "So I heard you will be judging the pageant this year. I competed 3 times. "I thought you could only compete once in a beauty pageant," I said. "We don't have a lot of girls on the island, so you can keep trying." The following afternoon, hundreds of residents of Spanish Wells stood on the beach to watch the arrival of a small motorboat. I had not seen this many people since we landed. As the boat approached, I could see a woman wearing a purple hat with large purple feathers waving at everyone. The crowd went wild. As she gingerly stepped off the boat, we were told this was a former Miss Bahamas who had come to be a pageant judge. The fourth judge would be the son of a wealthy Canadian family that owned a large house on the island. The next night, Francois and I, the former Miss Bahamas and the rich Canadian, who happened to be drunk, met with the pageant's organizer. She breathlessly explained that there would be a bathing suit competition, a talent competition, during which each girl would have to represent some aspect of life in the Bahamas, and a question-and-answer segment. This woman was so excited, it became obvious that the pageant was far more than just an entertainment. We were being asked to determine the course of the future for these young girls. I had always known that I would make a great god, but now that I had the opportunity, I wanted to run away. We were escorted to the pageant by the Englishman, who, like a fisherman bragging about his large catch, let everyone know he had reeled in 2 judges for the competition. The auditorium was packed with screaming people holding signs declaring their choice for the evening's winner, Miss Spanish Wells equals Chantal! Seated between the former Miss Bahamas and the rich, drunk Canadian, surrounded by screaming islanders, I could only hope that Pinder Market sold antacid. I had the same dreadful feeling I'd had the last time I was strapped into a roller coaster, although at least that experience lasted only a few minutes. If this evening ever ended, I would be adding judging beauty pageants to my list of things never to try again, right under gymnastics classes, and blood sausage. The MC got on stage and managed to quiet the crowd. He announced the names of the 6 girls competing for the title. 4 of them were Pinders. After each name, he had to pause a few minutes to let the cheering die down. At least if I ever compete in a pageant, my large, fertile Middle Eastern family will guarantee me a win for largest cheering section. The girls then all filed onto the stage, which led to more cheering and screaming and sign-waving. They drew straws to determine the order in which they would compete. First, there was the talent competition, during which they were supposed to represent the Bahamas in some meaningful way. Contestant number one came out wearing a lobster costume that can be kindly described as homemade. "I represent the lobster industry," she began. As she spewed out lobster statistics, her stuffed lobster arms and legs bounced up and down, giving the impression that she was waving to eight people simultaneously. Contestant number two